What up? What up? Jimmy Murray here with Frank Petalano, and we are the Cashflow Kings. The Cashflow Kings podcast discusses money, finance, mindset, and investing with an emphasis on cash flowing real estate.
Thanks for joining the Cashflow Kings and welcome to our new episode, How to Turn Military Moves into a Rental Property Portfolio with Joe Riley. We are here to help you crush your goals.
So, guys, I know contrary to popular belief, Airbnb is not dead. And this gentleman with us on the podcast this morning is going to take us into a little bit deeper dive how he built his portfolio while working in the military and working at the White House. Joe, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
No doubt. No doubt. So, I know that we had a chance to catch up a little bit before we dove in here, but I mean, we had a pretty good conversation about the culling of the herd that's going on in Airbnb. So maybe that's a good place to start in terms of what you're seeing out there and why you think Airbnb is still a good investment.
Yeah, I mean, the short-term rental world is like most nascent industries. I mean, you can look at the tech bubble that you had in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then how, that you're going to go through ups and downs. And as the industry becomes more sophisticated, those ups and downs follow a narrower band. So if you take the short-term rental industry, really, was just a mom and pop kind of vacation market only business until the onset of Airbnb and VRBO and some of the other marketplaces that made it easier for people to advertise a property anywhere to a broad population, as opposed to I go back to Destin every year or to Martha's Vineyard or wherever I might go vacation, and I just rent from the same rental company each year. And so that kind of progressed along steadily and grew without a lot of ups and downs until COVID. And then COVID obviously just, wiped out a whole huge portion of the industry. I mean, there were large billion-dollar plus companies that went into bankruptcy. Those were on the kind of multifamily arbitrage side, but huge kind of bloodletting. Then everybody who was able to survive come 2021, when you had this, pent-up demand that was all of a sudden released with a now significantly diminished supply, and people had a lot of stimulus money and everything else. They could work remotely. All of these factors came together and just sent the short-term rental industry through record highs from a RevPAR and rev for years. RevPAR is revenue per available per available room in the hotel industry. Oftentimes in the short-term rental world, you'll hear people call it RevPAN, which is revenue per available night, indicating that a three-bedroom house, it's not what's the revenue per each of those bedrooms in that house, but what's the revenue for the single unit that's rented. For the house. So you had this huge explosion in that. And then on the flip side, on the long-term rental side, people were, it's kind of a nightmare in some instances. People weren't paying their rent, they had deferment. So then everybody's hearing, okay, we're making 20 plus cap unlevered, cash on cash, returns, cap rates, in the short-term rental world in 2021, which was not uncommon. I mean, our cap rate, our unlevered yield on cost, cap rate in 2021 was in the mid-20s. Right. And so then everybody came flooding in over the course of 2022 and 2023, with more properties. Well, the reality of it is the supply and demand characteristics in the short-term rental world are a lot more sensitive than they are in the long-term rental world, because there's a much smaller population of people in any given market, particularly if it's in the non-vacation market, looking for short-term rentals versus long-term rentals. So then in 2022 and 2023, you have this huge influx in supply, and it really damages pretty substantially the unit level economics in the form of RevPAN. So if you're a company like Airbnb, when people say Airbnb is dead, Airbnb, the platform, is doing better than it's ever done, right? Because those sorts of platforms, the property management softwares, any of the businesses that benefit from the overall rise in both supply and demand, do very well. That's another kind of myth that's out there, is that the demand for short-term rentals has fallen off. It's just not true. Demand continues to grow each year. The problem has been that, demand was growing at a 6, 7, 8% rate, and supply in some instances was growing at 20, 30, 40%, rates. And so that is where you had your supply and demand imbalance that emerged. So then where does that leave us today? Particularly over 2023 was a rough year, right? Because all these people who bought, and then the real challenging thing is when you had all this influx of investors, whether they were people converting their existing long-term rentals, or there's somebody who watched the TikTok or YouTube or whatever else, somebody standing outside of a Lamborghini in a house that they rented for a day and claimed it was theirs, here's your way to be a millionaire, by getting this Airbnb. You had people flood in and buy all these homes that they should never have bought, right? That were too nice, too large, too expensive to be able to catch, per your show, to be able to cash flow, right? And so the consequence of that is now you've got this a lot of inventory in the market that is on variable rate loans or some other kind of, silly financing structure that they shouldn't have done. They're too expensive. And, to just try to stay afloat, they keep cutting rate. Well, then if we bought a $200,000 house that, would have made $55,000 or $60,000 a year as a short-term rental and would have done well and would have had guests who were happy and, run good occupancy, then some joker goes and buys a $1 million house thinking that he's going to make $1 million by buying a $1 million house that does $60,000 in revenue. Well, the guests are then going to go to his $1 million house. But the problem is, even at making $60,000, he can't, that's a terrible investment, right? And so, and that's not cash flowing $60,000. That's a top line revenue of $60,000 on that $1 million house. And he's going to pay his utilities, his FF&E, his, cleaning, his all the other stuff that goes in there.
You mean there's
So,
other costs? I'm
yes,
just
there are other costs. I wish that I could get people to believe that my top line revenue, because the top line revenue is often three, four, if not higher, X what it is in a long-term rental, but then there's a lot of costs that come out of that.
which is
So,
funny. Like a lot of people brag about their gross revenue, right?
yeah.
It's like how much you get to keep.
Right.
Doesn't matter how much you make, it matters how much you get to keep.
Yeah. I mean, I have houses where I have gross revenue over $120,000 and lose money on. I mean, that's,
Yes.
so anyway, so that's all of that to say what's going through the industry right now is a maturation process, right? Where you had all of these undisciplined investors who came flooding in, bought all of these homes that they shouldn't have bought either because they were, too nice, too expensive. They spent too much money on them and they had unrealistic expectations. They watched the TikTok video and thought that the TikTok video that said $60,000 a year top line meant $60,000 a year bottom line. And now they're in a world of hurt. And then those properties are, exiting. We had a guy reach out to us the other day. I can't say what market it was in, but he had somehow amassed this, $30, $40 million portfolio of homes. And hadn't even used traditional financing, had just had people in his, demographic community give him money that they thought were loans, but were actually unsecured. They had no deed of trust or anything. And it
Whoa.
was just total mess. And, then he went and took that and took 30% acquisition fees and had some big wedding in Cabo and, and
Oof.
like the, it's the classic case. And so then, but now all of a sudden he's got to get rid of it. So now you're seeing these people just got to dump this stuff, and get rid of it because they're under the gun. So what I think you'll see is already we've seen some of that undisciplined supply exit the market over the first part of this year. And for the first time ever, our 2024 numbers are beating 2023 numbers for stable shelf properties year over year performance. So 2021, best year in history. Don't underwrite to it. Probably not going to happen again. 2022, 2022, probably more of a kind of bellwether year to underwrite to. 2023, really rough, right? In 2024, we're starting to see come back to, more of a normalized state. And I think 2025 will be the first year that we see where we're back to a kind of stabilized run rate equilibrium. And I think ultimately you'll find that short-term rentals should trade, given the additional headache and operational intensity, My guess is that on a cap rate basis, short-term rentals had to trade at about a 400 bip premium over long-term rentals. And so then your arbitrage opportunity, to the extent there's one that exists, is that you partner, which is kind of what we've done with large capital partners who, they may say, look, if I'm having to deal with all the headaches myself of a short-term rental, take all the calls on Friday nights, deal with all the drama, all the pissed off guests there, all the nightmares that come along with that, then I probably want a 400 or 500 bip premium over what I'd get is just putting a traditional tenant in there and being done with it. But if I'm a large pension plan or other institutional investor, my yield premium's probably only, maybe 150 bips or something like that, mainly for reputational risk or something like that. So then the arbitrage opportunity is to buy these things once stabilized at, in small numbers and build them at, at a kind of 400 to 500 bip premium, and then be able to sell them stabilized in a packaged portfolio to institutional investors at a 150 bip premium, and then pull a 25 bip premium, or 20, 25 250 basis points premium on levered basis, and that's kind of where you're expecting to get your really positive returns, at least on the ownership side.
Joe, what markets are you in?
We're across the Southeast. We started while I was in the military, and so we have a high density around military bases, and then realized that it wasn't just military bases that generated the demand for this kind of housing. And so we're in university towns, major hospital systems, port cities, any sort of thing, any sort of market where there's a high demand for short-term housing.
I was just thinking because there's a lot of places where you're talking like 20, 30% increase in supply. And I'm thinking there are some markets that were 100, 200% increases in supply year over year. And that really crushes a short-term rental market.
I mean, if you were in a lake community, lake communities were the hardest hit, right? Because, most all homes on the lake are second homes. They had historically not been short-term rentals because, unlike a beach market or a mountain traditional ski market, where there were these management companies designed to manage, that existed for a long time to manage other people's rentals, and that was kind of a thing. If you had a beach house, you kind of, you know, you, and if you have a lake house, you use it some weekends, not other weekends, maybe you're out there part of the time. So it doesn't, historically, it would make sense to use it as a, third-party short-term rental. But then when Airbnb and Vrbo and all these others made it a lot easier to list it yourself or other smaller managers cropped up, then all of a sudden you had this large inventory of homes that actually were a, natural fit to be short-term rentals, but hadn't been. So that you saw a lot of increases there. And then the other markets where you saw particularly high increases in supply, it was unregulated markets, right? Where there was, no caps or permitting process or anything like that.
Makes sense. Makes sense. So as you're in the military, what got you into real estate, right? So let's talk about how you get started.
Yeah, I was deployed in Afghanistan with the Rangers, and my wife is a consultant, and
I'm
so she
gonna call you out for a second. You're probably a real Army Ranger before they change the standard based on the visual that I'm getting right now. So respect for that.
I don't know. I'm not standing up. My fat belly at this point would say that I'm certainly not one today. Maybe I was one at one point, but so I was in Afghanistan, and those deployments tend to be shorter in length. They're not 12-month deployments. They're more frequent, but they're shorter in length, so weren't conducive to bringing in a traditional 12-month tenant. My wife traveled for work. There was no reason for her to come to home to Columbus, Georgia, on the weekends, and so we just threw our house up on Airbnb and HomeAway. Quickly realized there's a big need for furnished short-term accommodations around military bases. No surprise there. I came back, didn't want to give up the cash flow, so I moved my wife and I into one bedroom of our three-bedroom house and continued to rent out the other two rooms. And then, I was just a redneck farm kid, and so then I started. There were these houses in the downtown area of Columbus that were in these kind of transitioning neighborhoods, or kind of crack houses and whatever else. And, but they'd be a street or two over from, really, good street. School districts were terrible, so people weren't buying them for long-term rentals. But I thought, who cares if you're coming in for a weekend or a week or a couple of weeks or a couple of months? Who cares what the schools, school districts are? So then started buying those, flipping them. We'd go in. I had a guy charge me, threw him through a window as I would go in, and just because you'd have these just like total squatter houses of just like abandoned nonsense. So then flipped those around and went to the next duty station at Fort Campbell, and did it there, did it at Fort Jackson in Columbia, South Carolina. And that's where we realized, hey, there's a lot of university towns generating a lot of demand for this. You can make a lot of money on football weekends and graduations and other big events around the university. And so I kept doing that. And then actually when I went to then I took out my first decent sized loan, portfolio loan, to go buy. I think we bought like 15 homes in one package then. And it's the day after I closed on the loan, the Army said, "Surprise, you're going to Ukraine." And I thought, well, this is how I go bankrupt, because how am I going to manage this, operationally intensive short-term rental portfolio from a shipping container and rural Ukraine? And luckily one of the guys I was going with, his wife had been a West Point grad, former Army officer, gotten out and did real estate, and said, "Look, hey, Kate will kind of take care of things while we're deployed." And that became our secret sauce of many of the people who work on our team are military spouses. So you have this, really qualified, underemployed group of folks who struggle, because of how often they have to move. So we started, doing that, and then came back from Ukraine, went to the White House, ran our, kind of was the director for Indo-Pacific security, leading our kind of counter-China policy in the Pacific for the last 18 months of the Trump administration. And then, when the new entrants entered the building, my services were no longer desired. So I left,
You're in good
got out.
company.
Yeah, left, got out of the Army, and then came back and ran the business full time. And we then went out and raised some capital. And so we've gone from, in 2018, we had just the one house or whatever it was, and now we're about 600 or so.
600 rentals. Oh, all right. So talk to me about, like, what was your, I've always heard struggles in terms of financing short-term rentals. So when you started in the beginning, you're buying these in cash, you're raising private capital. What does that look like for entry?
I wouldn't have, I wouldn't be able to, in full disclosure, I would not be able to do today what I did then, right? Because we started in 2018, and we benefited from significant increases in property values and a decreasing interest rate environment. And so we were able to, take lines of credit that were margined against public securities and other things of that sort, and then use that to acquire the homes. And then when we'd finished the renovations, we would then go ahead and refinance out at the new appraised value, and then pull that equity out and just then kind of recycle the line. And then based off the track record that we had, we were able to get a regional bank or two to back us. And then we started using some more regional banks. And so we used some, specialty DSCR style lenders, but a lot of what we did were regional banks in those markets for the permanent note position. And then, through combinations of seconds and margins off of publicly traded securities, using that for acquisition lines and things of that sort. And then, after we'd done it for a year or two, we had in our success record, particularly after we were able to kind of survive COVID, which took a lot of other folks out, got the bank a lot more com banks a lot more comfortable with being able to back us on different type of financing structures. And then ultimately we're able to put together, I think, what's probably the first nine-figure style loan facility in this space. So
It is huge. So essentially, you start out doing anything you can, then you get a track record, and then the floodgates kind of open from there. And share that with my team, right? And they're like, "How do you have access to this capital?" I'm like, "Well, you have to build the track record. So it's going to be tougher in the beginning. But once you have that established track record, people are going to come out. You're going to be able to attract that capital. It's going to become a lot easier. Then it's just a matter of finding as many opportunities as the capital you have available." It sounds like you guys have done a very good job of that.
Yep.
If
That's
there was
it.
one, go ahead.
No, I said that's exactly what it is. I mean, yeah, there are definitely some tips and some things to avoid in real estate. But a lot of it is just hard work and discipline, and that's
No different way you're in the
we had
military.
a guy come work for us, and I don't know, he was a couple weeks into it, and he said, "Joe," he said, I don't want to do this anymore." I came here to learn about business development and real estate, not about changing toilets and flipping locks. And I said, well,
You're gonna be good at the small things.
I hate to break it to you, but I, started out by flipping locks and changing toilets, and I still do it sometimes. So,
Good man.
Joe, how many markets are you in right now?
we're in 13 states.
Gotcha.
So how do you scale your team across those 13 states? Like if you say, hey, listen, I'm gonna enter this market tomorrow, what does the team look like when you enter that new market?
So we're in full disclosure, we are not entering new markets anymore. We're trying to increase our density in our existing ones. You have to partner. It depends on if you're, when we would enter a new market, we would often enter it through rental arbitrage. So we would go and find leases, sign leases, because the underwriting's tough in this industry. And so then once we were able to underwrite the revenue, it's not as difficult to underwrite the expenses. The challenge is underwriting the revenue for a given property.
Gotcha.
And so then we would get these leases. And then once we were kind of confident what the revenue profile looked like, then we, could underwrite the expenses and then we'd start buying there. And, until we get to, sub five homes in a market, it's pretty decently easy to manage remotely. And then, you can just get a, cleaner who's got somebody who can do some basic maintenance and lawn care or something along those lines. And then, the challenging time is kind of from 5 to 20 homes because you start to get to be too big to have to do everything remotely with no W-2 support. But then you're not big enough to be able to justify a W-2 salary. And so that's the challenging part. And once you get to kind of 20, 25 homes, then the kind of difficult increments then become in kind of 25 home steps, right? Because that's about, as you look, if you had another 25 homes, you probably need another FTE. Are you going to lean more towards somebody who's more of a maintenance person, more of a housekeeping person, more of a business development person? So that's those are the challenges that you're facing in any given market as you're scaling up.
So are you doing mostly single family homes?
Yes, we do some multifamily, but most of it's single family.
How do you staying remote with most people being remote, that team, do you have like a sense of community in the team or do you guys have meetings? How does that work?
We do it helps that a lot of folks come from a similar background of being veterans and military spouses. In some instances, that's how they came into the company in the first place. But I mean, it's challenging. There's no way around it. Slack wars are anything more brutal than Twitter wars or Slack wars. And so trying to get people to, pick up the phone, call each other, spend some time in person. But yeah, I mean, we've got employees who've never set foot in a single home or never seen another employee face to face. And we've got, employees around, even military spouses deployed, with their husbands stationed around the world. So there's, it's a challenge for sure. There's no water cooler.
How has all the regulation, the short-term regulations, affected your business?
It has, in all honesty, at the early days, I was terrified of the regulations, right? Because I'd totally screw everything up. Now, in many instances, I don't mind a little regulation. If there's a problem with supply, something to help keep out a little bit more of the undisciplined supply is not a bad thing. But at the same time, I love going to, city council or county commission meetings and tell them, I started the company while deployed in Afghanistan, built it while deployed in Ukraine, and now that I've come home, I have to go and answer to the local Politburo that's going to tell me what I can and can't do with my private property. And so that message resonates typically better in county governments than the city governments. And luckily most of our stuff is in the southeast where there's not everybody's well, I'll let my commentary stop there so I don't offend any of your listeners.
Good. No
No,
worries.
most of our listeners
Need to
got,
hear it.
yeah,
They need
happy
to
to hear.
hear it. They probably agree, honestly, right? We believe in free market capitalism here, so you're in good company.
Yeah, it is amazing. I was at a county commission yesterday, and they were talking about it, and this lady, was just losing it over, and she said, if something happens to my daughter, her blood is on your hands. I said, this is, what are you just being
Well, that's
ridiculous?
a pretty
And
deep swing conclusion there, right?
and she
But
was going, she was like on this rampage about Charles Manson, and like, Charles Manson's, lurking, and it goes on this like 3 minute thing about Charles, and then thank God one of the county commissioners who's got, both a sense of humor and a little bit of reasonableness, he goes, ma'am, I'm sorry, but I forgot the part where Charles Manson conducted his murders from an Airbnb. I said, it's just these people who just get crazy about this stuff. And then they want to tell you, I mean, what you, again, private property rights are a real thing. If you don't like how I use my house, you can buy the house. And then my
Right.
other favorite one, that I love to just, that kills me, all the people who are anti short-term rentals, that, they'll get up and there'll be these association groups or whatever. And, the first one person will stand up and they'll be like, these short-term rentals are destroying our property values, right? And the next person will be like, no one can afford to buy in this neighborhood anymore because short-term rentals are driving up the property prices so much. And it's like,
Well,
it's one or the other. Pick which one you want, but they can't be driving it up to where it's on, no one can afford to buy and destroying your property values. And I had
absolutely.
a my last funny story that I'll tell on this is that I had a neighbor reach out to me because in some of the original homes, it was just me at the time, so the neighbors still have my phone number. And so I get a text message from, the Karen of the neighborhood, and says that somebody's parked an RV out front, and this is destroying, and just goes on this whole thing about. And I said, well, is it legal? Is street parking illegal on the street? And of course, the answer is no. And I said, is the RV parked in front of anybody's house but the house that I own? And the answer is no, it's not parked in front of her house. Street parking is illegal. It's parked only in front of my house. And she goes, well, it's destroying my property values. I said, are you selling your house? And she goes, no. And I said, okay. And I said, but for the record, I looked up your house on this estimate on your house is $180,000. And that's a $400,000 RV. So I think if anything, your house is bringing down the value of that RV.
Probably didn't like that, but I mean, there's the
No,
truth. It wasn't ready
no,
for.
yeah,
Are you going to spin that into, by the way, your estimate on your house is 180. Can I buy it for 180? That's where I would have gone.
right, that's
Hey,
right.
listen, destroying values. I'll give you fair market value before Zillow knows that that RV's across the street. I got you. Let me take care of you before.
That's right, that's right. It's like a property assessor in my county says, he says, anytime people call me complaining about the assessment, he says, I tell everybody I'll buy their property sight unseen for 10% over the assessment.
There you
They probably all say no, right? That's a
Yeah.
good
All right. So I have questions that we ask every single person that comes on. First question is, if someone wants to become a better investor, what would you recommend?
point. Apprentice, intern, do something to get some sort of real world experience from whoever it is, whether it's real estate or whatever, everybody else's business is super easy to run, and there's no real such thing as mailbox money. So, go apprentice under somebody who's skilled in the investment class or trade that you're wanting to pick up, before you go and put a lot of your own money into it.
Next question. What is one book that you have read that you would consider a must read?
I don't know. I would say that I'm a very religious guy, so I always default to, I think the Bible includes a lot of great wisdom on how to treat other people and how to run your business, and you'd be amazed, I think how much you can glean from that Anyways, that's my own kind of personal
Review
view.
some Proverbs once in a while.
So I was going to ask that. I was going to say any favorite components of the Bible, any favorite books, chapters?
Yeah, to him who much is given, much is expected.
Love it. Love it.
Last question is, what do you want to be when you grow up? Which means, Joe, 5 years from now, where do you see you and your company?
Well, what I love doing is we have a farm. So I grew up on a farm, and we bought a farm a year or so ago, and we're building out all sorts of silo homes and tiny homes and glamping sites on it and stuff. And we've got cattle, and we brought a school on the farm. And so I enjoy doing short-term real estate investing, but I would say that my passion is really around agriculture and helping, farmers find ways to, make money off of their legacy farms, particularly small farms in the Southeast, that are difficult to compete with the main agri farms. And so we're doing a lot of different things to help work with state legislatures to relax some of the zoning and regulatory requirements on farms, so that they can do things like tiny homes and glamping sites and camping and different festivals and stuff, to find ways to allow, this large, growing population of people who lives in the cities and suburbs who've never really spent time on a farm, but who want their kids to be able to understand a little bit about where their food comes from, to be able to leverage these awesome, beautiful farms, to be able to, share with the communities and do so in a way that makes them economically viable. And so that's my kind of passion project.
Love it.
Love that. I have a coach, and he always talks about how people want to brag that they're purpose driven, but they try not to be money driven. But you can't be money driven without the purpose. And it shows how you set up your business, and obviously some component of money driven, and you're driving it right back to your purpose. And I respect that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
So, Joe, we appreciate having you on the podcast. If anybody wanted to reach out or learn more about your business, what would be the best way to do that?
And just shoot me an email at joe@patriotfamilyhomes.com. So that's Joe, Joe at patriotfamilyhomes, homes is plural, .com.
Good stuff. So you guys heard the man. Go check him out. Shoot him an email and check out one of his glamping sites. That sounds kind of cool, the farm.
Yeah, you can come stay on the farm. We got tiny homes, glamping sites, yurts. We do farm tours. So Chattanooga, it's only 10 minutes from downtown Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh yeah, guys, you heard the man. Go check that out. We hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Cashflow Kings podcast. In between podcasts, check out our daily content on Instagram and Facebook under the Cashflow Kings. Cheers to your success.
The Cashflow Kings program is for basic entertainment purposes only. We do not give official, legal, tax, or investment advice.